WTC We Talk Comics, episode number 30, A Visit to Lombok's Graveyard. And that title will make sense in just a few minutes. I'm Mo, going to go through and introduce the two gentlemen who are sitting with me today. First off, and we'll get them to introduce themselves with one of our favorites, what have you been reading, watching, or doing lately, Chris?
I've been checking out Touchwood, and I've been reading a limited series called 68.
And Keith, how about you?
I have finally finished reading Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, which was on my list of books that I have never read from the great canon of comics. And most of it I really, really liked. I thought it kind of bottomed out for a little bit, but I love the way it ended. And glad I finally sat down. And I just finished watching the short-lived TV series The River, which I really loved. I'm a sucker for found footage shows and movies. So I'm hoping someone picks that show up.
Namo and I have been reading the 1995, mid-90s Marvel miniseries Cosmic Powers by Ron Mars. And I just with this week I watched Goon, which was just a remarkable movie. Sean William Scott was absolutely fantastic in it, and so funny for such a pure and innocent movie with so much hockey violence and the F word once every 45 seconds on average. Simply a tremendous performance. Really great movie. Remarkable. So anyways, let's move on here to the weekly news with Cub Reporter K.
Well, Chicago's C2E2 convention is going on, so there is a mess of news. I'm going to try to hit the top stories. We have DC announces a He-Man miniseries written by James Robinson with art by Philip Pan.
DC has me back. Hey, guys, growing up, I wasn't a Transformers or G.I. Joe guy. I was He-Man. He-Man was my thing. That was the action figures I had. That was the cartoon. That was everything. Oh, the cartoons were better for the other ones, but man, I was all about the He-Man. That was my favorite. Hell, you know what? Come to think of it, DC at the time was doing some really good actually work with He-Man, and then what was it? Marvel with their Star series did some really good work with He-Man too. The He-Man comic books, highly underrated.
You did a lot of drugs back then.
11. I was like 11.
Those were not good books.
So probably, yeah. Started young. Yeah, they were. Oh, the Star stuff was good. But either way, love me some He-Man. I'm so there. James Robinson, too. Philip Tan, excellent team.
And they've also announced National Comics, which, from what we can gather, is an imprint. It will be a series of specials, one-off, done in one-off issues, likely number ones all. It is not taking the place of a New 52 title, but they are set in the New 52 universe. So they'll be treated more like a miniseries, all of which will have one issue. They start with Eternity by Jeff Lemire and Cully Hamner. Other characters coming up, Madam X, Rose and Thorn, and the Looker.
Rose and Thorn makes
Outsiders.
Me think of Bone.
Rose and Thorn's a 1970s character.
You know what? Sounds like we'll finally be reviewing some DC regularly again pretty soon.
I have my fingers crossed. I'm really hoping this line is mature content. To me, it just reminds me of how Vertigo
started.
There's
so much content out there. I don't mind something that's not.
I would argue that there's a lot of adult content. There's not necessarily a lot of mature content.
Keith, you got it in one.
I also would like some of that early Vertigo stuff before they really split off. Vertigo
Image?
Didn't take place in the DC universe. Image, there's a lot of, yeah, I'm talking about mainstream. I'm talking about DC. Yeah. I think between DC and Marvel, it just is. Marvel's Max line is almost closed down. The mature readers label, which DC pioneered in the 80s with Swamp Thing and Sandman and all those books and Shade, which came before and set up Vertigo. I'd like to see those kinds of books again. All right, moving on. We've also got some Marvel shakeups. But
wouldn't you say something like Animal Man within the new DC 2, DC 52?
Yeah, I wouldn't say none. I mean, I said there are a few. I mean, I would say Animal Man, Swamp Thing, and I know JL Dark has the potential, but I don't know. Red Hood and the Outlaws, I wouldn't necessarily put in that category. I'm enjoying the book. I'm enjoying the book, but it's an adult book. Okay. It's not a mature reader book.
I just like to see a place where something like Mike Grell's Green Arrow could exist.
And I don't see really the difference. Yeah,
or
but I think
Alan
it can.
Moore's
I think it already
thing.
Does exist within the new 52 without a new imprint in issues like Animal Man and the Swamp Thing that Keith mentioned and
I think my argument though, and it sounds silly whenever I say it, but it is one of the defining things is those books had nudity, those books had foul language. The ones that are being made by DC right now just have violence. And it's not like it has to have boobs for being a good book for me, but they had a variety of ways they could tell a story. And if they had to swear in it, then they had to swear in it. But I'm not seeing that in New 52. All I'm seeing is violent books that aren't for kids. I'm not seeing proper, written for grown-ups like Green Arrow.
I also love the National Comics banner that they're bringing that back.
I actually don't know. What period is that from, Chris?
That was before they named it DC. It was the parent company was National Comics. National Comics originally published Detective Comics as a title, and then that was more popular, so they changed the name of the company to DC. So that would have been the 30s. I don't have the specifics, but I just like the shout out to their origins.
Yeah, I love that Detective is technically Detective Comics. Comics
That'd be
presents
awesome.
Detective Comics. Is the proper full title of that book. Okay, we are really moving on now. DC's also announced that the digital first line that they've been playing with the Beyond books and Smallville Season 1, will expand to be a new digital first comic Monday through Friday. Monday will be Anikami Girls, which is an anime-inspired book with female characters from DC. Tuesday will be Batman Arkham Unhinged, tying into the Arkham Asylum game, series of games. Wednesday will be the revolving Beyond books, Batman Superman Justice League. Thursday will be Batman Done in One stories, similar in style to the Batman Black and White books from the 90s. And Friday will be Smallville Season 11.
It's an interesting concept. We'll see how well it works.
Sounds like fun. Definitely Mondays and Thursdays for me.
I'm definitely in for that Batman. That sounds really fun. I was a big fan of Batman Black.
Well, I tried all the Beyond series, and the Superman, not so good. JLA, awful. And the Batman was very good, so.
News that I was disappointed by, but I'm sure that other folks will be happy. Ryan Stegman will be leaving Scarlet Spider this summer and will be moving to join Jonathan Hickman on Fantastic Four.
Join him on?
That's
what does that
July
mean?
Or August.
Okay.
He'll be doing the art on Fantastic Four. Ryan Stegman's doing the art on Scarlet Spider, which I've really been enjoying. But I'm waiting for Hickman to leave Fantastic Four to give it another try because I really wasn't into what he's been doing. I'll be missing Stegman for a while.
Oh. Pham is taking over the art on Scarlet Spider, and I have to say I've seen some of his stuff, and it is really going to be interesting.
Okay, all right, Keith, let's keep going.
All right, we've just got the announcement of our ongoing Hawkeye series starting in August by Matt Fraction.
I won't be reading that.
Art by David Aja.
I won't be reading
that. It is a street-level crime-fighting book. Mo is not a Matt Fraction lover. Given that Matt Fraction is one of the likely candidates to take over the Avengers line, there will be a whole chunk
of
this.
Yeah, also, you know what? Frankly, I like my Hawkeye in the Marvel Universe. I like my Ultimate Hawkeye in the Ultimate Universe. I don't like what they have right now in the Marvel Universe, which is like a mixture of the two. It's like he's like the current Marvel incarnation of Hawkman is the bastard love child of the original Hawkeye and the Hawkeye that they put in the Ultimate. So,
well, speaking of the Ultimate Universe, the Brian Bendis book Spider-Men, which has been teased for a little while, has officially been announced as a celebration of Spider-Man's 50th anniversary and will be the Ultimate Universe Spider-Man and the 616 Spider-Man meeting for the first time. And this is the first crossover between the Ultimate Universe and the main.
I think they're trying to give the Ultimate Universe a boost because it just it doesn't have any buzz.
I would say this is the beginning of the end for the Ultimate Universe. We said this a couple weeks ago. We were asked what happens when the two finally do cross over after nearly 10 years of saying that it would never happen. And I think it's when you start packing
I think it's time to, personally. I think it's time to.
It was time 6 months ago.
6 months is pretty generous. And what else am I going to do here? We've got Kirkman is developing Thief of Thieves with AMC, the television network that
sure jumped on that pretty
Walking
quick.
Dead. And very quickly. And I think that when we reviewed number one, we were saying a lot of that this seemed tailor-made to be a TV series. Speaking of TV tie-ins, Dark Horse has announced extra Buffy Season 9 books, expanding its very successful Buffy the Vampire Slayer Season 8 and 9 series. New miniseries for Spike and Willow. There are currently two regular monthlies for Buffy Season 9. And another TV tie-in, Jericho Season 4, a series that I loved, and I loved the comics. Will return as a 5-issue miniseries this summer, continuing the storyline that was done 2 years
ago.
This
is really becoming a popular thing to continue the TV series this way. I think fans love it.
I really do, and I like when it's got the original creators involved. I mean, Whedon is essentially the editor in chief of what happens with the Buffy season 8 and 9 and the what was Angel season 6. And one of the writers from Jericho is overseeing plotting the Jericho Season 4 miniseries. I think it's a great way to continue these without the high budget and the requirement for the enormous
audience. Yeah, that's
one of the
advantages of Complex, obviously, is that you can tell a story without the budget and tell whatever story you wish. Yeah. Any other news?
Yes, it just keeps going. Marvel has announced that they are developing, and we've heard a couple of these titles before, but there is one or two new ones that will surprise you, for films. And we are waiting to hear what the second Marvel movie will be in 2014, going with Captain America 2. They are developing Ant-Man, Doctor Strange, The Inhumans, and Guardians of the Galaxy.
I can't say I'm really excited to see any of these as a movie.
Guardians of the Galaxy is gonna rock.
Well, I don't know. As a comic book series, it always should have rocked. It never did, and it seems to me it looks to me like Green Lanterns, how the enormity of the project kind of just collapsed under the weight of itself. I predict the same thing with the Guardians of the Galaxy movie.
I heard about it. Go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, yeah, you want a good movie. I don't care. I really don't care. I want to see a crappy version of the Guardians of the Galaxy. These characters aren't great in the comic books. And on the big screen, it'll be an awesome mess.
Did you enjoy Green Lantern?
I want to see that.
I enjoyed the stuff in Green Lantern that was in space.
Yes. That 3.4 minutes was awesome.
I thought everything on Oh was great, actually. I thought there was all the stuff on Earth was not any good in Green Lantern, but all the stuff after he left Earth was great, and it should have been.
All right, well, so of those four movies, though, the one that seems to have the most excitement among the group is Guardians of the Galaxy, because Chris is interested in the one. I'm not interested in any of them. Keith, are you interested in any of them?
Actually, I had a picture pop into my head as soon as I heard about Inhumans, and it is Black Bolt standing on the moon, just whispering a word and causing destruction. I think that's your teaser trailer right there.
Anyways, I tell you one thing that won't work on Servant. Doctor Strange. Who the hell's clamoring for Doctor Strange? All right.
They got my $14.
But you're paying for all of these. You're going to see, how does that make it any different than any other movie Marvel puts out?
I see a lot of movies. I don't know.
As long as Doctor Strange lives up to the promise of Ghost Rider 2.
And none of these are ones I would see. All right. Keith.
Comicsforheroes.org. We've talked about them before. They do great work. And they are currently taking cash donations through their website, comicsforheroes.org. And they will be purchasing copies of Superman Family Adventures, which comes out next month, to give away at youth-centric events and introduce kids to comics. So check their website out, and I urge you to slip them a few bucks to get some more kid-friendly comics into kids' hands.
That's awesome. That Comics for Heroes, yeah. I mean, that is just a good thing. I love it.
Well, I got an email from a fellow named Lise Lightfoot who asked me why it is that in the news when Mobius died, we never brought it up. And that was several weeks back. And I just want to say, Lise, a Scottish fellow, Lise Lightfoot, I just want to say to him that it's a well-known fact that Keith hates the French. You love poutine, but you hate the French.
Our absent co-host on assignment, Brett, would only be interested if Mobius had been cast in the Green Arrow
That's
TV
true.
Pilot.
But rest in peace, Mobius. Belated.
We all love Blueberry, and I think it was off on timing, and it felt like everyone had made their requiem. So, but we'll take a moment, and if this wasn't an audio recording, we would now
that
pause
seems like
for
a bad
minute,
choice. Yeah, full minute of silence. While some people may consider that an improvement, I really don't think we should throw that in there. But all right, Mobius. All right, let's. What we're going to have is.
Just to pause on the Mobius thing for a second. Did anyone see that crappy Blueberry movie other than myself?
Don't speak ill of the dead.
I will say, actually, right around that time, I tracked down, I think it's still on YouTube, Comic Book Confidential, which was a Canadian documentary about comics made in the 1980s. So interviews with Dave Sim, Steve Ditko, some really amazing creators at that specific time, Howard Chaykin. And Mobius is interviewed in that because he was such a huge name in France at the time. So.
Yeah, directed by Ron Mann. Excellent documentary.
Yeah, Frank Miller's, I've watched his clips from there many times. So
all newsmen drink, Jennifer. That's the kind of rough and tumble guys we are.
All right, let's move on here. We're going to have a slightly different format because we're going to throw to something really, really interesting that my two co-hosts here did earlier in this week. But so we're going to throw to the WeViews section early on here. So why don't you open up on this one, Chris?
All right. WeViews.
Here I come to save the day.
Let's start with Thor 12.1. This book is meant to be an introduction to the Thor mythos. It is written by Matt Fraction, so I'm sure Mo will hate it. Unfortunately, I have to agree with him. And not for any real reason other than it's a who cares book. There's no meat on the bone on this thing. There's nothing really happens. I guess it's a good introduction to what Thor is, but it wasn't good enough to recommend. And I found myself immediately forgetting
well,
it. Mo?
You know, I enjoyed this book because I've always been a big fan of Conan. Actually, I mean, as a one-off, it is a good issue as a one-off. Like, and it reminded me of Conan. It's more, this is a Conan story, not a Thor story, except for, you know, he had Thor's powers. The problem with this is, as you say, it's supposed to be a jump-on point. Well, I already know Thor. Everybody knows Thor, so you don't need to tell me Thor's, like, origin and history and these type of things like they're kind of doing. I just need to know what's happening currently in the Thor books, and they didn't tell me that. I mean, it didn't tell me what the current storylines is so I can jump in. It didn't do a very good job of that. As a one-off issue, it's enjoyable enough. Like I say, if you like Conan, you'll enjoy this. Keith.
I thought it was a great jump-on point for Volstagg. really told me who he was. I have no idea what it has to do with Thor. I know a lot about Volstagg. I mean, the whole concept of the point ones is supposed to be a jump-on point. And increasingly, it was never very well done, but at least they tried. And this, I have no, like, this doesn't help me at all.
Exactly.
With what's currently going on in Thor. Stories about him when he was 8 years old. I have no idea what I was supposed to be getting out of this book. I don't know why it has a point one on it instead of just being the next book.
No, it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And the art, though, by Barry Kitson is pretty freaking awesome. I'll give it that. Keith, why don't you jump in for the next review?
Well, let's talk about America's Got Powers number one, first of a miniseries of six, and a world where there are superheroes in a very Rising Stars-ish kind of way, that there is one group of superheroes that got their powers all at the same time in a unique event, so there aren't new heroes coming along. And there's a game show that they compete in. I enjoyed this book. I really like this book. I thought it was an interesting concept. I like that it's close-ended. I don't think that this has a long story to tell. I did find it a bit, like I said, Rising Stars. It has a bit too much of that to me, because it kind of hits a lot of the same notes of, you know, as I've said before, the post-superhero, it's a real world with superpowered people in it. And what happens is a little played out to me, but I did like the book. It's, you know, that it takes place in San Francisco helps, the city I love. I think I'm in for that.
I'll jump in here then. Of course, my joke was going to be that I'm a big fan of this series because I've always liked Rising Stars, but Keith has taken that one away from me. I didn't like it much at all. I felt the book was mean-spirited, honestly. I felt the book was mean-spirited in every way, and the characters were mean-spirited, and I just did not groove to anybody. And it's more the rhythm and the style that is Hickman here. It just didn't work for me at all. Did nothing for me. So let's, like I said, I'd rather read Rising Stars. They did it first, and they did it better.
Do you want to redo that? Because Brian Hickman didn't write this book?
Oh, thank God. That's right. He wrote Secrets. I was trying to grab the thing. Hickman didn't do that.
Because Jonathan
I won't
Ross
bother redoing
and,
it. We'll
Brian
just say
Hitch.
That it is – sorry, my mistake. It is Ross then. Hickman – sorry, Hickman did Secrets, so I got a little excused. But either way, I found it mean-spirited. I mean, particularly there's a bit in this book where they have a senator, a female senator, who looks exactly like a former governor of Alaska. and she's just a complete cow. And it just feels to me really mean-spirited. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not a fan of that of the former vice president running mate at all. But just like I say, just it's just the overall mean-spiritedness of the book to me that, that just didn't do it at all. Chris, what do you think?
For me, definitely, I was also getting flashbacks from Rising Stars and a few other series that we've had had over the years. I found the whole arena aspect of the series kind of interesting. Unfortunately, the world this is based in didn't ring true to me. It just didn't make sense. At no time did I believe this is what people in the real world would do if they got if a group got powers. Rising Stars, it made sense. Yes, we put them in a camp. But the way they handled these, it didn't make a lot of sense. On the other hand, I'm in for the miniseries just because I think we're going to get some mind-blowing action. I want to see where this is heading. Didn't like the book, but I might like the six books.
It's an interesting argument. Whenever you have that, what if superpower people were in the real world, there is that danger of, but I don't think that is what would happen. And then you're just kind of stuck. If you make a whole world that just happens to have superpower people and you don't try that kind of concept, then it can be whatever it is. But you find yourself going, well,
that was what was so brilliant about Rising Stars, right, was it really played out like, oh, God, that could happen. And that's where this feels really, really – like just like a lot of the stuff – like I say, the mean-spiritedness about the callousness towards innocent civilian lives by the people running this show, things like that to me do not ring true and seem mean-spiritedness. And it's too much, just too much. I didn't do it for me. But, hey, I understand. And didn't do it for Chris, but he's willing to stay on to the series. So this might be one we might have to look back and do an entire series run, even if I didn't enjoy this first one. It seems to have enough meat on the bones to be interesting for folks. Chris, there was a book that only you and I read this week that Keith didn't have time to get to. Why don't we do that one?
All right, Alabaster Wolves from Dark Horse. Interesting concept that we have, I guess. How would you describe this character?
I'll describe it here. While I can get Keith to look up the writer for me, so we can throw that name out there because I simply don't recall. But essentially what you have here is this is a story. It's taking place, and it becomes really, really obvious early on that even though this is the number one and it is an issue and a jump-on point for people in the series, this is actually a character who's been around for quite a while in novels. And so the established character, they kind of do – I think that is a little bit of a poor job of introducing you to this character, Dancy. But basically she's a girl traveling the country. She has an angel on her side, and the angels in this universe are not necessarily nice. They seem more like demons. But she's surrounded in a world with wolves, werewolves, that she is fighting off and looking to survive for. And in this particular issue, she competes with a werewolf, saying that she will allow herself to be eaten if the werewolf and her have basically a battle of riddles. And I love stories like this. I love the battles of riddles stories that have been done through the centuries. So that's kind of how I describe it. And like I say, it's a character that's pre-existed. Keith, do you have the author's name there? There you go.
I do. Caitlin R. Kiernan, who's done quite a bit of
the art is also, I thought, fantastic. But that's the concept on this one. It's basically, yeah, like I say, it's not a new character, but it's a new character in comic books. So, Chris.
Yeah, well, that's a little bit overview. More than I wanted, but
I loved it.
Right. Yeah, no, and I can easily see how you loved it. I did not love it. The whole Battle of the Riddles thing, I find fairly cliched and has never struck me as too fairy tale-ish. You know, if you're a Twilight fan, and you know, I have a set, so I don't.
There's
I'm
no
not
evidence
a
you have a set.
Fan.
Yeah, I believe that.
You have a set of Twilight?
He owns it. I, on the other hand, have never read a book or seen any of the movies, but Chris has, the guy who has a set. Yeah, you have.
No, I haven't actually, but
I have no opinion because I've never read them. Chris hates them. And he's
exactly,
never read them.
Me too.
I have no opinion.
Never read them, never seen a movie. Yes, of course he's
seen
the movies.
Seen the movies, let's be honest. I mean,
the guy who has a
seen
set.
Every movie.
All right, Chris, go ahead.
In addition to that fact, I found the fact that this is a limited series very strange because this is a one-off issue. The story ends. It's over. It's a one-off. Why do we have a five-issue limited series when you're going to end the story in the first issue?
I also thought it seemed a little bit like that story wrapped up and then it's continuing. But maybe we have to read the entire thing to see how it plays together. But I can see your frustration there.
Yeah, and I mean, I just didn't get the what was. I understood what was going on, but I didn't see the appeal. It was just too romantic, gothic thing going on. Not a good comic book in my estimation. But I know you liked it. And
how about the art?
I didn't find anything offensive about it. So, oh yeah, art was excellent. Okay. But
I think
once
we're
going to
need a deciding vote on that. So for next week there, Keith. All right.
I'll get right on it. I'll get my best people on it.
People who have a set, preferably. All right, Keith, why don't you move on to another review?
Well, here's a dicey book of the week. Iron Muslim by Rich Johnson. The editor-in-chief of Bleeding Cool gossip site. And I could not figure out whether I should be offended by this book or not. In the end, I decided not to be because I just don't think it has enough substance to be offensive. It is such a lame book. It reminds me of those, you know, the times in the 80s and 90s where those companies could put out the parody of New Universe or Secret Wars one-off parodies, and they would be so forgettable, and they would still ship two copies to every comic store. And at the time, that meant you could publish a book. It's a parody of Iron Man if Tony Stark were an Iraqi who made a suit of armor that he got inside. It's as cliche and every Iraqi is a terrorist as you can expect. And I think if you look at the cover of this and think, ooh, maybe that has a compelling socio-political commentary to make, then you deserve everything you get picking up this book.
This book's awful. I mean, you know, if you take what it is and it's clever, that'd be one thing, but it's just poorly drawn and poorly written. And the narrative is strung together, well, poorly. So, I mean, forget about the content and the offensiveness. It's almost too stupid to be offensive because it's so poorly done. You're going, I can't even be offended by this. It feels like it's done by a 12-year-old, a series of 12-year-olds. Chris, what do you think?
I enjoyed the Fred Hembeck pinup. Beyond that, I have to agree with you. It sucked. I thought Fred Hembeck was actually dead. So
there you go.
It was nice to see him working again.
There you go. And if he does die, Keith will mention it 1 month later. Or not at all, Mobius. Anyways, Chris, let's move on to the next move or the next comic book.
All right. Secrets number one, the new Jonathan Hickman book. I've gone on the record before saying I am a huge fan of Jonathan Hickman. And I was excited about this book. And then.
Gather your thoughts. It's okay.
And this pisses me off because I wanted to like this book so much. Every once in a while you get a book from a good writer that he stretches himself too far into unfamiliar territory. This book is about corporate espionage and spies, and it didn't make a hell of a lot of sense to me. None of it rang true. I didn't believe any of this stuff could happen in the real world. Did not enjoy the concept, the book, anything. I will not be continuing. And it makes me sad because I love so much of this writer's work.
It's a mean-spirited book. But it's probably not – didn't bother me as much because it feels like it's a world where the mean-spiritedness isn't tacked on but more organic to the universe. I think Hickman has fantastic dialogue, but in doing so he often doesn't give context to the scenes because it's so realistic that it becomes sometimes difficult to understand exactly who the characters are and what's going on. I think that's something he could probably work on. I think the art in this is really well suited to the story. I think this is intriguing. Probably just because I'm not a Hickman fan, I won't follow it, I don't think, but I think it's intriguing. It's one of those books that's, it could go either way for me. It's like, I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. I'm curious on it. It's really, if we were using our old buy, bag, or a burn list, this would be right in the, in the buy list, just to put it that way. Like, I don't know quite where to go with it yet. And I'm not sure if I'm going to come back or not. It's 50-50.
I think I'm inclined to try a second issue, but the more I think about it, the more it feels like extra ideas he had from Manhattan projects that didn't fit there. I don't really know what kind of substance there's going to be. Right now, there's only as much as a direct-to-video action movie. There's nothing super compelling, and I actually had, right before we recorded, I had to go back and flip back through this book again to remind myself what book it was, because it had only been 2 days since I read it and still
it doesn't really plant anything in your minds. And you know what, I got to say something else, that this is a book contains the, from Image, the mature readers label, and I believe it contained the S word once and some scenes of violence. Meanwhile, we had America's Got Powers, which I counted had 23 F words and was a teen plus book. So I think Image, I've said this before, I think they do a really, really poor job on that, on presenting the proper context for what their series should be. That's an utter fail. I love Image, but they're not good on everything. Okay, let's move on, Chris, to our final – or Keith, I guess I thought you had more to say, but I guess you're done there. So let's move on to our final review. Do we have any more, or is that it? That's all you had, Chris? That's it? All right. Well, then we're done.
I can't think of another we had.
That's all right. We didn't even do the We Views song. This show has a little bit of a different rhythm because we're not going to Brett editing it. I'm going to do the best I can. I won't be editing out a lot of that stuff. So people, I hope you can kind of see this is a little bit more of the behind the scenes look of what a We Talk comics podcast is like. But let's move on here to our final little bit then, the interview, I guess you guys did. Keith, why don't you set this one up, and then Chris, we'll get your comment on it.
Well, a couple weeks ago when we did the Twitter episode, one of the questions was about digital comics, and it was such a great question that I started emailing back and forth with Paul Longbox Graveyard. He runs the blog Longbox Graveyard and is Longbox Graveyard on Twitter. And we had a couple of emails, and he was such an authority on a specific area that's not in comics, but is related to the discussions that we've been having of digital comics and the future of where digital comics should be going, models and the support and marketing, etc., but from a very outside digital publishing, and felt we could expand this into a longer discussion. So we invited Paul tomorrow.
And Chris, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, no, it was it was an interesting interview. I definitely learned a lot. I was definitely over my head with some of his expertise in the digital realm and where comic books were heading. Yeah, definitely interesting. I don't know if I agree with him completely, but he definitely knew way more than I do about app development and the marketing of comic books. I hope he's wrong, because I found some of his conclusions quite depressing.
Well, you know what? I think once everybody listens to this and we listen to this, next week the four of us, and hopefully it will be the four of us this week. Of course, we're missing Brett and some other things to take care of. And We Talk Comics is kind of like a hand. If you're missing one of the fingers, you can't really close it and make an effective fist. So I hope he's able to come back next week and join us, and we'll have a topic. We'll kind of get into it in our own views from what he said and reactions to this interview. First off, I just wanted to commend you two. Both of you two did an absolutely fantastic job on this, and I've listened to it, of course. Paul is brilliant and fascinating, and really, really hooked into a lot of stuff. So I hope he will give us an opportunity to talk to him again in the future about this topic and some other ones. I really, really appreciate that he was there. I was going to attend, and then we had a freak snowstorm here in the middle of April in Calgary that kept me at work, so I could not. So, I think everybody's going to love this. This is a really, really good stuff.
I'm Chris at WeTalkPodcast.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at Chris_WeTalk. I am pleased to announce that I have now doubled Brett's I'm double the popularity of our missing co-host.
So you're excited about doubling the guy who never is on Twitter. That's good. Good point. Yeah, that's effective.
Yes. I'm no longer dragging behind the guy who's never on Twitter.
All right, Chris at WeTalk Podcast, Chris_WeTalk. Keith.
You can email me, Keith@WeTalkPodcasts.com, and you can follow me on Twitter, CubReporterK. And after some crazy times in my paying job, I am hoping to get back to doing some serious reviewing or at Comicosity. And looking at the final issue of Deathstroke, which I hear is being relaunched as a number 9 with Rob Liefeld
really,
writing, but I won't be following that.
For Jared Olive? Yeah.
I know.
Feel free to throw another blog up for us, too, because people love your blogs. Your blogs are terrific. Those New Universe ones that you did for us. I'm going to throw a shout-out for everybody if they didn't read those $4 blogs that Keith did for us a little while ago. They were fantastic. So, other than that, my only other... What's that?
Captain Canuck. Captain Canuck.
That's next.
I've never heard that story.
Secret history of Captain Canuck.
Excellent.
Yes, I need to hear that.
Excellent.
Other than that,
I'm going to say we're hoping to be attending the Calgary Entertainment Expo in a couple weeks, Comic and Entertainment Expo. That's in a couple weeks' time. And if we are able to attend and get some stuff there, there's a lot of celebrities, a lot of artists that we hope to have interviews with and maybe bring you guys some more good content in that direction. And other than that, we'll try and always set up some interviews online like we do, and hopefully keep everybody entertained. We Talk Podcast is expanding. We got a lot of stuff going on over there, so keep checking it out. And other than that, we're OUT. @Mo_WeTalk. @WeTalkPodcast. M-O, no E. And now we're OUT.
All right, we're here with Paul O'Connor, Longbox Graveyard on Twitter. And in our Twitter episode, Paul had sent us a really great question on digital comics and the future of digital comics from our perspective. And we felt that it was such a big topic that we wanted to expand outside of that episode. And it became our next episode. And then Paul sent us a great email of his perspective as someone who works in... Is it iOS apps, Paul?
Yes, we're a developer of apps for iOS and for Android, although primarily we're an iOS publisher. You know, as far as this particular field is concerned, I am an app developer. I do have skin in the game. I've co-founded a game developer called Appy Entertainment. We've been at least moderately successful. We've got 15 million downloads of our games. Did a game recently called Spellcraft. We've also done Face Fighter. We've done Trucks and Skulls. Our games have all been featured by Apple, have been top 10, top 20 titles in most territories. So I know a lot about the business from the app point of view. I don't know a lot about the business from the publishing point of view. You know, as far as what's going on with Marvel, DC, just what I can observe, but I can put things through a filter and I can make pretty good guesses about what's happening with them on the publishing side. So I have exact knowledge in some areas and speculative knowledge in others, but it might be good enough for your purposes.
And this is an interesting perspective because what we've talked to comic creators, we've talked to comic publishers. A couple of us on the show have a perspective of having run comic shops in the 90s, and we can all talk about it in terms of being readers of comics and lovers of the art form. But it is a many-faceted question, is where digital comics should go, what model should we be looking at? And I think that's really what we want to get into. And now Paul's been upfront that he is not an expert in digital publishing, and that's okay. That's not what we're looking for today. What we're looking for is we've been trying to find that model that's outside of comics, as opposed to an ebook model, which I think most people are looking at right now. I think that there are other things, and you know, I've brought up iTunes many times as something that I think comics should be looking at as a model. But so Paul, from your perspective, digital comics.
Yes, well, I enjoy digital comics. I've yet to, I can't bring myself to spend $3.99 for an individual digital comic. I think the pricing's all out of whack. At least it is for me. But I do have a subscription to the Marvel Digital Unlimited service, which gives me access to their back catalog, that I think has been a terrific value. And there are some problems with that system as well, but on balance, I've been very pleased with it. So most of my reading of comics now is digital, as awkward as that may be, you know, because it's on a computer and there's a lot of disadvantages. Consume the media that way instead of just laying back on the couch and flipping through a book. I would like to read comics on my iPad, but I really have a very difficult time paying even 99 cents for a comic, much less, you know, $3 or $4 as is presently being requested.
Now the Marvel system, that's a subscription and then you read unlimited, correct? Like a Netflix model?
Yeah. So what's one of the problems, you know, it's a consequence of growth because the space has evolved so fast. And, you know, if we could turn the clock back 4 years and come up with our master plan, I would expect Marvel probably would do things differently. But right now there's kind of a Chinese wall between their various systems. There's the digital side, which is run through the Comixology app. And there's a branded version for Marvel as well. And they have a pretty nifty cross-platform solution where you can make one purchase through one of the Comixology apps, and then it's available to you all platforms, you know, whether you're on an Android phone or on an iPhone or you move to your computer, you can look at your data any way you want. And then there's this older system, which is the Marvel Digital Unlimited system, which is all Flash-based. And Flash won't run on iOS systems. So even though the iPad would be the ideal portal to view this material, it's not available on the iPad. You can only get it on a PC. So and those systems don't cross over. So you make purchases on one side and you effectively rent on the other.
Yeah, I've had the same problems because I use the iPad as well, and the Marvel Unlimited does not make any sense to me. I mean, who only reads Marvel and never a DC? And at $55 is a little ridiculous.
Yeah, horses for courses. It's $55 for the year. I think I got mine for $40. I got a special deal at Christmas, which was fine. I'd welcome a similar system on DC, but for whatever reason, that's not presently available. I've gotten a lot of joy out of my Marvel system because it's allowed me to go back and look at a lot of Silver and Bronze Age books, which are my specific areas of interest. It's a substantially less good deal for someone that's interested in contemporary books because they're, you know, they're a couple years behind newsprint, which is also kind of strikes to the heart of where I think digital comics are really stuck, is that the market is evolving unnaturally because the publishers have to protect their print channel, and they're terrified. They really can't make, begin to experiment with pricing or distribution the way they should to figure out exactly what the market is. Instead, it's evolved as this kind of strange extension of the direct market model, and that's a disservice to both digital comics and to conventional comic distribution, I think.
It is a strange spot that the market's at. I mean, you talk about this pricing, and I mean, what it really amounts to, and you know, we try not to speak ill of the local comic shops. We were talking about this before we started recording. But right now, it is ultimately protectionism. It's price control based on the so-called bricks and mortar stores. That's why they're priced the way they are. It has nothing to do with supply and demand. It has nothing to do with the actual costs of making the books. I know there's Comixology's cut, but it's no different than a store's is. So ultimately what we have right now is price control based on the bricks and mortar stores. We don't get discounting except for, you know, a month later. What's strange about this whole thing for me is that I can go into any bricks and mortar store and get a discount if I have a pull list, but I can't on Comixology if I have a pull list. So I'm actually paying more for digital right now. Considering that it's nothing to go into a store and get, you know, 10 or 20 points off for your monthly package. But you don't get that on Comixology. There's no membership where you're not, hey, where they're not 20% off if you're a member or anything like that. And there's never a bargain bin on Comixology of remaindered books. Sometimes they have a special offer, but it's not really the same thing. So right now it's they are trying really hard to make their digital model fit what I don't even know is a realistic real world model, like hard copy model.
You know, I'm of two minds when it comes to digital comics pricing. I have a hat that I wear as a fan, and I have a hat that I wear as an app developer. As an app developer, more power to those guys. You know, if they can price protect, if they can sell a digital comic for $3.99, hallelujah, good for them. Because this is the most competitive, most cutthroat, free market we've ever seen in terms of software distribution. It's a brand new world. And it's a world where literally 99 cents is the premium price. And actually free is too expensive. I have to pay people to download free apps. I mean, let that sink in. All right. In this business, on our side of the fence, where there are no price protections. I mean, when I got into app development, our company got started in 2008. When we came in, we thought, no problem. We'll be able to sell apps for $3.99, $4.99. And we built all our projections around that. And then within 6 months of the market opening, it all pancaked down to 99 cents and free. And that blew a lot of guys out, frankly, and the rest of us had to adopt in a hurry and figure out how can we make money off free in order to survive in the market. Because the friction between free and 99 cents is impossible to overstate on the app side. We have a game called Face Fighter that we were selling for $1. And Face Fighter is a decent game, but actually a very good game. And we might sell 500 copies of them a day. And this would have been in 2009. And then we set the app free as a promotion. And within a week, we'd moved 1 million copies of that app. 1 million copies. That was the difference between 99 cents and free for us with Face Fighter. 300 copies a day to 1 million copies in a week. And then when we set the app back to paid, our paid sales went up. because what happened was the app was now more readily available. More people knew about it. It had all these collateral benefits on the App Store, which we can get into if you want, about organic lift and rank position that help bring your work in front of people's eyes. And it also, because a million people had downloaded the game, we had a million evangelists out there that now were playing the game and telling their friends about it. So when they hunted it up on the App Store, a dollar didn't seem such a big deal anymore, whereas before it was a gigantic barrier. So that's the way the app side of things work. There's no way that I could sell my games for $3.95, and I make games that have, you know, 200 levels that you can play for 10 hours or indefinitely, absolutely free. And I couldn't sell those games at for $3.99 for what Marvel's able to get for, you know, a single digital issue of Avengers versus X-Men. So as a publisher, I wish I could sell my apps for that much. And if they got some special mojo going on over there where they can sell those copies in sustainable numbers and everybody's making money, then good for them. Now, I don't think that it's a sustainable model. And I actually don't think they're making that much money in the scheme of things. And that's where you get to kind of the scary part, which is where, you know, eventually, I think inevitably they're going to have to cut free from price protection for, especially for brick and mortar stores, and embrace the way digital pricing works, which is you have one of the problems on the App Store is that the pricing is insufficiently granular at the lower levels. So you can set something to free, you can set something to 99 cents. You can't price anything at any level in between those two. And that's why you see games with virtual currencies that allow the publishers to set prices at any level they want. And I'm really surprised. Now, maybe they'll roll this out and they're just working on it. We don't know. I'm really surprised that they continue to stick to this 99 cents, $1.99 free pricing levels rather than building a more sophisticated storefront, either on their own. You know, Marvel or DC certainly have the resources to build their own storefront. I'm surprised they continue to stick with Comixology, which has, you know, frankly, a pretty old fashioned store in terms of the way they monetize and price their goods.
And it's interesting that the number one, I mean, we don't see real numbers on digital comic sales, but everyone knows that the highest selling digital comic was the one that tied into an app. And the name escapes me. It was a game comic tie-in. It was a game app that they did and it was a 99 cent, but it was in the game. There was an ad of, hey, do you want to read a comic book based on this game? And people did. And, you know, a million copies at 99 cents is a hell of a lot better than, you know, 2,000 copies at $3.99.
Yeah, it's tremendous. And there's a hidden value, too, which is the more copies you have in circulation, the more people you have reading your material, the more people you have looking at advertising, perhaps, if you have advertising support, the more people you have that like your book and they're talking about it to their friends, recommending it to their friends. There's also, I've mentioned before, is the phenomenon called organic lift. The way the iTunes store works is it's built to support frontrunners. A lot of people turn on their phones and only look at the top 25 apps in any given category. So the apps that rank highest continue to rank highest. So if you have a lot of downloads, even if they're not paid downloads, it'll boost you up into areas where there's additional visibility, which widens your funnel, which gets you more customers that potentially you can monetize. So you may be giving away your product for free to a vast number of people. That's the way it works on the game side. But you're hoping that the funnel's wide enough that you're going to find those core customers that will eventually pay you. And that's basically a numbers game. That's one of the reasons that you have to set your app for free, is because you need customers in the millions before you can make, you know, a profit off the 5 to 8% of the people that are actually going to pay you for the work.
Is it up to Marvel and DC, do you think, to find this business model? Or is this an opportunity for independents to experiment? Because I don't see a way out for Marvel and DC. They can't abandon their core business.
Yeah, and you know, they're chained at the hip with this core business, and they may end up going over the side of the boat together. I mean, eventually they're going to have to break that chain. The great advantage that Marvel and DC have is they have this tremendous vault of intellectual property. They have superhero characters and other characters, you know, they build up this brand equity for 50, 75 years, and people love those books. You know, people love Batman and Superman, Spider-Man, the X-Men, Fantastic Four. These are these are precious assets for any company to have, and that's the reason they're able to call the tune. An independent company can come along and publish their comics through all sorts of, you know, interesting ways, but for the majority of people, again, we're talking about a mass audience now where we're trying to reach millions of readers as opposed to, you know, the couple hundred thousand that are now buying print comics. In order to reach that mass audience, as far as they're concerned, comic books are superheroes, and that's what they want. So, you know, they go into an independent comic, you know, to a storefront that's set up by an independent comic digitally, they're going to have some real hurdles to try to cross to reach a mass audience. Now, about the only way they can reach that mass audience is set the price low, set it to free so lots of people sample it. Maybe they love it and they continue to try it. But there's still going to be the issue of the initial hurdle of finding those users. It's not easy. It's still a very, very crowded market. And it's hard to get noticed.
Well, and maybe it's a company like Archie that does that, or IDW that's got the licensed, Boom that's got licensed, something that crosses into a broader audience. You know, I do wonder about, you know, I always talk about iTunes, and it's not just with iTunes. There's two things for me. One is the standard player that works with everything. You know, I can get from an independent producer that does an MP3 to, you know, the latest Madonna. I can play it on the same player. And I mean, Comixology starts being that, but I don't think it ends being that. And the other thing is, and this is actually something I'd like your perspective on, Paul, is for me, one of the things I still don't like about digital, and the reason why I think of trade paperbacks as my permanent collection and not the digital as my permanent collection, is the file still doesn't live on my hard drive. And if Comixology closes tomorrow, my collection has disappeared.
Yeah, and that's a fear, and it's a legitimate fear. But, you know, the thing you need to understand is that Apple and Google and Amazon are all investing billions of dollars in cloud server farms to, and part of that is to educate consumers to give up physical media and move their devices onto the cloud. And that's the way the future is going. I think 10 years from now, actually less than that, within 3 to 5 years from now, we'll look at the idea of having media, any kind of digital media on a physical form, as being positively antique. And it, you know, you can think back, you know, there was a time where people didn't want to get their cash from automatic teller machines. They wanted to talk to an actual person. They were afraid to touch buttons and get their cash. There was a time when people with their music libraries were afraid to have most of it stored locally, much less, you know, on a cloud. But people are gradually moving to that standard. And I think that's where digital publishing is going to go as well. So, I mean, I hear you. I feel the same way. And especially as comic book collectors, we love to touch and hold things, right? That's part of the pleasure of being a comic fan, is having a big shelf of graphic novels or plenty of neat little long boxes that are full of books. But in my estimation, I think, you know, just speaking personally, is I think the original books have value because they're unique, especially the older books. They may be inferior as a reading experience in a lot of ways, but they do have collector value. And I think digital forms have value because they're portable, because you can edit them, you can move them around. They're, in many cases, you can see the print better than you can in paper. To me, when I look at trades, aside from maybe a real high-end omnibus or something, I see that as a transitional form. I look at those and I kind of see 8-track tapes, to tell you the truth, because I think it has a sense of permanence, but I have a feeling that we're going to be dumping those on eBay the way we're trying to get rid of comics from the 90s right now.
Well, whenever anyone makes the hard line of that argument of you need the hard copy, whenever I see a reference to because of the resale value, I just laugh my fool head off.
Yeah.
Because I've been a collector since the 90s. I can count on two hands the amount of comics that have significantly increased in value in my collection in 25 years. The idea that that my 1 through 8 of Deathstroke is going to be worth anything.
Yeah, we got to love this stuff for its own sake. And before I came on the air with you guys, I was packaging some stuff up to sell on eBay that just finished off on auctions. On one of the auctions, I lost money outright. I'm probably down 5-8 bucks, you know, not even counting the cost of the books. And on another one, I'm up about $10, you know. I'm selling my books just because I want to clear out space, and frankly, because I find digital to be more convenient going forward, but not because I expect to make any money off them.
Well, I'm keeping my paper copies, but I have to say I've converted to digital just because I can find issues, because I'm always missing an issue when I go back.
Yeah, that helps too. Although, you know, the browsing experience on iTunes is no good. I feel. I mean, I'll say that as an app developer, I'm very dissatisfied with the browsing experience on iTunes. And I think the browsing experience of the Comicology app is much better. And that's one of the issues, frankly, with digital is the digital is only as good as the search experience. And those are areas that need to get a lot better, especially for search and discovery so people can find new apps. But that points to the advantage that DC and Marvel have with these terrific asset libraries is that people can, it's easier to find Batman than it is to find, you know, an independent comic that you can't quite remember the name of it.
Well, and definitely. I think I want that interface to be, I want the comic shop interface though. I want the surprise 99 cent book instead of the every Friday we have a sale. Where I'm just wandering through the app and like, oh, well, today these books are only a buck.
Yeah, online browsing, it's no good. But the lesson of history is that the most frictionless, least expensive method of distribution is what's going to win out. So here in the United States, the Borders book chain closed recently. Barnes & Noble is still here, but maybe not in 3-4 years if the prices continue to race to zero and people increasingly turn to Amazon as their choice for fulfillment. It's inferior to walking into a bookstore and discovering something. I agree. But it might be that's something people are willing to give up in exchange for cost. And when that happens, then the power of those brands becomes even more important because, again, it's easy to search for something you already know that you want. It's very difficult to discover something new unless it's through a heavily curated store. And even then, it's really tough because you have so many new people jostling for attention and only a few of them can be featured on any digital store.
Well, that's an interesting perspective is often we talk about these kinds of changes in digital and, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we were talking about this in music. The idea that digital would open things up and independence would be on an even playing field and, you'd be able to discover all these new bands. But what I've found is you get to iTunes and what's the only thing that's in my face? Madonna. The same thing was in my face 15 years ago in a record store is still what's in my face when I go to the iTunes store. So do you think it actually opens up or are we just going to end up with like Superman and Batman being the most common, the easiest to find digital comics as well as?
I think you're going to get a lot of Superman and Batman. I'm old enough to remember when, Star Wars was a date picture for me. Okay. So I go way back and I'm old enough to remember when movie theaters were primarily single screen experiences, big, wonderful movie palaces you'd go into. They'd seat 400 or 500 people, big screen. And then where I grew up in Southern California, they started carving these things up and turning them into multiplexes. Before they had dedicated multiplexes, they take these existing theaters and they carve them up and turn them into 2 or 3 screens. And then the multiplex came in and had 8 or 10. And I remember at the time it was, this is going to be a golden age for independent cinema. Because what's going to happen is we're going to show the big blockbuster film on one screen. But there's 4 other screens for us to fill. So we're also going to have a B picture and we're going to have a foreign film and we're going to have this little indie film that you never heard of. We're going to have a documentary. I mean, and people are going to come to the theater and they're going to see for the big blockbuster and they're going to see all these other films that are on display and it's going to be a golden age. And of course now, fast forward, at my corner theater has 18 screens and 12 of them are showing Hunger Games right now. And that's great. Hunger Games is a fine picture. But the additional screens haven't allowed other independent voices to come to the fore. If anything, they've been pushed further into the background. And all the theaters that I went to as a kid that showed second-run stuff and foreign stuff and, old science fiction pictures and stuff, they're gone now. And the voices that used to be viewed on those screens are also gone. And I think you're going to see a similar thing with digital comics or any kind of digital media going forward. Again, in the case of the App Store, I have a little insight into that because I've had apps featured on the App Store. My company, Appy, we've had them there. When Trucks and Skulls launched in 2010, it was the iPhone app of the week. It was the iPad app of the week. It's the highest endorsement you can get out of Apple. I mean, we shared equal billing with Oprah Winfrey, for crying out loud. It's crazy, right? And I just have this little company. So in a way, Apple's given us this most wide open market possible where I can compete on equal terms with these media giants. But getting to the top of that hill is extraordinarily daunting because there are thousands of people competing for that very, very narrow space. And then even if you do get into that narrow space, it's no guarantee of continued success. My company's been successful. It hasn't been as successful as we'd like, despite that kind of promotion. And independent comics artists are going to be in the same boat. It depends on what their expectations are. So, I mean, we are in a golden age right now. If you're interested in web comics, if you're looking for free stuff, there's never been a better opportunity for creators to control their own work, publish it on their own terms, put it out there for people to enjoy. But very few of them are making a lot of money at it. And that's because generally it's a niche market. And when the mainstream thinks of comic books, they think of superheroes, and the superheroes are controlled by the big publishers, not by these independent creators.
Sorry for the multiplex, by the way. Canadians invented that.
Did you? One more thing to be angry about. Ice hockey, maple syrup, and multiplexes. You swine.
We were thinking of changing our flag to just those three things.
Don't forget the Skidoo.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry, the snow machine.
The Zamboni, we call it down here, I think. Oh, no, I'm talking about the ice resurfacer. The snow machine, I couldn't tell you.
Just out of curiosity, I just came across a new app at the App Store called Double Feature that is selling webcomics 2 for 99 cents.
That's interesting.
Yeah, no, I kind of liked it. Especially since the webcomics were actually really good. Unfortunately, they package two together. You get episode one of one and episode four of another. Huh. But interesting app anyway.
Well, there's a lot of ways to skin the cat. And if I were building a comic book storefront from the ground up, I would build it with virtual currency. So the way it would work is that let's say I'm Marvel Comics. I can push a button and make this thing happen. The first thing I'd do is I'd hire 15 or 20 talented software developers to work for me in-house. I wouldn't try to shop it out to any small studio because you need those. You're going to need to keep them on a short leash, and you're going to need them in-house for the constant maintenance and updates that the app's going to require. And then I'd concentrate on building a terrific user interface and a store. And the storefront, I mean, part of it would be to address these browsing issues we've talked about. But the most important aspect of that store is that they need to separate currency and purchases, which none of the apps – it's kind of what you're talking about, the double feature app. So what happens if you want to buy a Marvel comic online, it's going to cost you 99 cents or it's going to cost you zero, and there's nowhere in between. What they need to do is set up that I'm going to come to the Marvel store, and there's going to be a lot of stuff I can get for free. And there's going to be some stuff that I can get by spending virtual currency. And that virtual currency is bought at a whatever rate I set. So when I'm at the store, I go, okay, I want to buy these books. Let me convert some cash. I'll spend $1.99, $2.99, $3.99, $15, whatever I want, and get some Marvel dollars. And then with those dollars, I can go crazy and buy whatever comics I want. That the prices are a little cloaked from the user, but what it will allow the company to do is to set their prices lower than a dollar if they want, and also have a graduated pricing scheme so they can have some books being cheaper than others. And also they can quickly change it through a wireless patch and adjust the prices on the fly based on demand or whatever kind of promotion they're running that week. And then the other advantage is once you start giving away some portion of your inventory, you can turn your comics into a social platform. Where it's easy, once you let go of this idea of that you're going to carefully rights manage everything and try to restrict the images, instead you want people to distribute them far and wide. You embrace a piracy model in effect. You encourage your users. Yeah, they bought the app or the comic and they're going to share images with their friends. But once it becomes a social platform, you can incentivize your users for reading and sharing your books. So I've gone ahead and I've bought, Avengers versus X-Men number one, and I paid a premium price of 99 cents for it, and I read the book. I really liked it. I get to the last page. An option comes up immediately for me to rate it on the spot, which ties me back into the review community. It also gives me an opportunity to recommend two or three friends that might like it. And just the act of recommending those friends, of pushing the book over to their email address, they're able to give that user a few more Marvel dollars for free, which he can go back into the store and spend on something else. I mean, there are real virtues to a virtual currency system. That's why I'm surprised that we haven't seen that yet out of the major publishers. And I really can't see it taking off and growing substantially until they put something like that in place. And I think I know the reason why they haven't done it, but it's real speculation on my behalf.
Really, yeah, really interesting to look at some different models of how it could be done, because, I mean, right now it still is so grounded in the, like, it's a physical book digitally. It's still the way it's being treated, as opposed to, you know, we don't talk anymore about digital music and hard copy music. It's just music and, you know, different ways of getting it. We don't need a qualifier. And, you know, we didn't have 10 years ago the record companies going, oh my God, we've got to make sure that when you download an album, it's still $20, the same as it is in, you know, the record store. Cause they've got to match. We can't be cutting them out. And, I mean, that said, those record stores are disappearing fast.
Yeah, they're gone. You know, the major chains, you know, Tower Records down here in the States, when that went down, it was a big shock to everybody because they were the big power broker in music for so many years. You know, the cold reality that the music business had to wake up to is, even though the business has come back, largely because of iTunes, I think, it's still only 40% of what it was at its peak. You know, the music business was on this incredible roll where LPs were enormously profitable, and then the CD revolution came out and they managed to sell everybody their library a second time, made a lot of money off of that. They were just swimming in cash in the 80s and the 90s, and then it all went away overnight. And I think, you know, the publishing companies are looking at the same kind of equation where they say, gee, you know, I'm seeing these trends and I'm seeing the numbers, and really what I need to do to survive is, right now I got to fire 50% of my staff, and I have to change the way I make things and distribute things. And, you know, a lot of the guys at the tops of these companies just aren't incentivized to make those kind of changes. It takes real vision and real courage to disrupt your own business. There's few companies that can do it. Apple's done it. You know, they're not afraid about cannibalizing their existing base. They'll sell you iPods, and then they'll sell you an upgrade on the iPod, and they'll sell you an iPod Touch, and that iPod's not worth so much anymore. And they disrupt themselves before they can be disrupted externally. But there's very few companies that are able to do that. But that's exactly the equation these publishers are looking at, the comic book companies, not least of all, is, do we have the courage to really blow up our existing way of business so that we can build this new thing on top of it? And, boy, there's not one company in 100 that really knows how to do that.
Especially publishers.
Yeah, well, you know, they get wedded to things, and that's, you know, I said I think I know why they haven't gone to a virtual currency model, is because I think, you know, here's the thing, is the top-selling print comic in March was Avengers versus X-Men number 1 at a little over 200,000 copies, 203,000 copies, I think. And the number one DC title was the Justice League issue for that month, and it was 130,000 or something. So, and the comic sales were down in March after having grown for several months, largely propelled by the DC relaunches. But they still, the top book in comics isn't selling more than, you know, 200,000 copies on a good month. Now, if the worldwide comic market has collapsed to the point where you can only sell 200,000 copies of a digital book, then they're in real trouble and they don't dare drop prices because they will lose everything. The only equation where it makes sense to drop prices is if you think that there is a market out there in the millions for this material. And I suspect that what Marvel and DC know in their heart of hearts is that through poor stewardship and some very suspect editorial choices over the last 20, 25 years, that they have so reduced the market down to just, you know, a beloved hardcore, that they can't make comics for a broad market anymore. And if they can't make it for a broad market, they don't dare go out there and pursue one. Because, you know, if they take existing editorial, they take the material they have now and try to go broad with it, most people aren't going to get it. Most people aren't going to be interested, and they won't pay for it. So it's a multifaceted problem. They've got the brick and mortar network, which they need to protect because that's where they are making their money. They have an editorial problem that they may be blind to and unable to correct. And then they have the digital pricing problem they got to figure out. And, you know, unless and until the business is really going out of business, I don't know if they're going to be able to make those hard choices.
It is something that Dan DiDio said when they were relaunching. And I think that he has a more realistic view. I mean, I've had I've had my issues with some of his editorial thoughts and decisions, et cetera, over the years. But it was an interesting thought that he said, we can't be at the point where we have 10,000 people paying $20 a copy.
Yeah, and that's just and really that's what they deserve, right? Because that's what the business has turned itself into. You know, this multiple covers and variant issues, and you know, it's all predicated upon people buying multiple copies of a comic, some of which they don't even open and read because they're speculating on its value, or you know, that's where the publishers have led themselves these last couple decades, and they've driven away a casual audience. You know, so Avengers is going to come out in the movies in what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, right? I'm all very excited about it. I'm certainly excited about it. That first weekend, what was I looking at? It just came onto tracking, studio tracking in terms of people's interest. So right now, 20% of the audience expressed a definite interest in seeing Avengers. 23% say it's their first choice for the weekend. So it's tracking for a gigantic opening. Now, the biggest opening in superhero pictures was Dark Knight Returns, which did about $158 million in its opening weekend. A couple weekends ago, Hunger Games opened at $150, which was spectacular. So let's say that Avengers, with this level of interest, doesn't even hit that level. Let's say it hits $100 million for an opening weekend. I think it'll do better, but $100 million is certainly doable. That $100 million box office equates to what, maybe 8 or 10 million people going in and seeing the movie first weekend at in North America. Now, if you could produce comics that would appeal to those 8 to 10 million people as opposed to the 200,000 people that currently print them or currently go out and purchase a print issue, then you'd have an opportunity to make some waves digitally. But I'm not convinced that they can. And even if they could, how's a new reader supposed to figure out what book to read? So Avengers is coming out. It's got this gigantic marketing behind it. So say it drives me into a comic shop and I say, hey, I heard this Avengers thing. I want to buy Avengers. I mean, where do I even start? This is, to me, is an example of the editorial problem that Marvel and DC have. So I went onto the Midtown Comics website today and just looked at their pull list for current books that have Avengers in the title. And this is what I saw. I saw Avengers Annual Number 1, Avengers 1959, Avengers Academy, Avengers Academy Giant Size Number 1, Avengers Assemble, Avengers Assemble One Shot, Avengers Origins, Avengers Prime, Avengers Solo, Avengers vs. X-Men, Avengers vs. Pet Avengers, I'd try that, Avengers Black Widow Strikes, Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes, Avengers Roll Call, Avengers The Children's Crusade, Avengers The Origin, Avengers X-Sanction, and that doesn't include Dark Avengers, New Avengers, Secret Avengers. I mean, where on earth is one of these mythical new readers that's attracted to the superhero business, which is going great guns, how on earth can they get started with an Avengers comic? It's baffling.
Well, and they can be so – the comic companies can be so disconnected from that idea of seizing these opportunities. I mean, sometimes they do right. Like Free Comic Day was created to tie in with the release of the first Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was because they expected so many people would have interest in comics that weekend that they wanted something that drew them into the stores. But last year when Green Lantern, the Green Lantern film was coming out, and there would be more interest in Green Lantern than in 50 years of history of the character, it was Tomasi, the writer of Green Lantern Corps, who said, but we're in the middle of a crossover, of this like gigantic crossover. When that movie comes out, you can't walk into a store and start.
Right, because he's protecting the 48,000 copies a month that he's selling of Green Lantern or whatever it is. I mean, these companies are huge fiefdoms. Everyone has their own area of interest, and they're looking after it. That's the way business works. I totally get it. But it's an indication of the dysfunction at the publisher level that they have so many titles chasing so few dollars that it completely pushes casual readers out of the market. And without casual readers, the market's eventually going to dwindle away to nothing, digital or no digital.
Well, in his case, yeah, it was that editorial and publishing was in the middle of a giant crossover. I'm like, well, we'll have this giant thing happening when people are excited about Green Lantern. And Tomasi's like, no, I think we should stop the crossover for 2 months in one of the books and do one-offs. So it was actually the writer had made that decision, but editorial wasn't even paying attention to it. and you know, yeah, publishing wasn't paying attention to it.
And even, you know, even in that case, with his best intentions of making the book more entry level, and I don't recall specifically, I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I'd bet you two things. One is that there still were a blizzard of Green Lantern books on the stands, leading to consumer confusion when they came in. And they didn't, it's not like they suspended the whole line and only published one Green Lantern book that month. And the other thing is, I'd be willing to bet you that the story that the comics professionals thought was accessible in broad market was not. I mean, when DC launched their new 52, late last year, it was advertised, depending on who you talk to, as either a soft reboot or it was this vast, you know, bold attempt to attract new readers by setting the books down in issue number one and inviting everybody to jump on board. And I got to tell you, if that's their idea of a point of entry for people, then the business is doomed because the books were Byzantine, difficult to understand, complex, relying heavily upon past continuity. They reinvigorated their base, but they didn't do anything to bring new readers in, but I believe they thought they would. And that's the scariest part, because it's like what happens when you set monks to revise the Bible. You know, they get hung up on the heretical distinctions without a difference, and they miss the larger case, which is, you know, no one can understand this book to begin with. How on earth are we going to get people to read it and pay attention? And that's the editorial problem I think that Marvel and DC are facing is so large they can't even perceive that they have it. So instead, they'll look at, you know, sales successes and they'll say, hey, well, print comic sales are up and these superhero movies are making all this money, so the future's bright. And, oh, digital's coming along and that's going to allow us to recruit new readers and gradually grow the market. And, you know, the comic shop business, well, yeah, there used to be 9,000 shops and now we're down to 2,000 or 3,000, but the shops that are there are good shops. And the whole thing's going to come back, and they can construct all sorts of scenarios where the business is going to be just fine. But I think that probably what's happened is that the business needs a different level of curation in order to grow to new readers, and that's why they're price protecting these books at $3. Because if they drop the prices, they're just going to lose profit because they're not going to find a wider audience to come in and consume the material that they're making for the hardcore right now.
Well, it's interesting talking about New 52 because we basically launched We Talk Comics right before that. Mo and Brett founded the show, and then Chris and I kind of joined a little later. But when we went to the New 52, we decided we wanted to go through all of them, but we weren't interested in reviews. We didn't want to be a review show. So what we actually were looking at was, can you understand this book on its own as a number one, and reviewing it purely on, is it exciting? Is it accessible? Is it interesting without anything else? And, you know, coming from very different perspectives of, you know, a couple of us who are hardcore readers and Brett, who hadn't picked up a DC book in 15 years. Chris was somewhere in the middle. It was something that came up a lot was that idea of not only is it accessible, but are you just shifting the same readers around? Are you actually bringing new people into the store? And, you know, it did get back lapsed readers. And I think I'll credit them with lapsed readers, and I'll credit them with moving some readers around, because certainly there was a real big dent in Marvel's market share. At the same time, I don't think those new readers that they dreamed of really appeared.
Yeah, and putting a dent in Marvel's market share, good. I mean, that's what they're supposed to do. They're in business. They're supposed to compete. But the thing is that Marvel and DC, to me, are two guys sitting in a rowboat out in an ocean full of sharks, and drilling a hole in the other guy's half of the boat doesn't make you any safer. So, yeah, you go steal steal readers from the other guys, that's fine. It gives you a bump and you can say we're up 2% or 3% this month or whatever. But it's not going to help you long term, especially if your editorial is still focused on special events, crossovers, expensive, alternate covers, and then hoping everyone's going to go out and buy it again and trade. People are going to get tired of that, and they have been getting tired of that, and that's why the long term trends in sales and comics have all been down, despite the bump we've had in the last, you know, year, 11 months, driven by this DC reintroduction.
Yeah, and we've recovered. I mean, the market's recovered a bit from, I mean, it really kind of bottomed out about 10 years back. But it's been ups and downs, and unfortunately, even the peaks are not as high as, you know, we were talking about the time that we know the most about for comics is I ran a store in the early 90s. Paul, you were working in comics, you know, as a freelancer in that time.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the time I know the most about. And, you know, the numbers are nowhere close to this. I mean, AVX was supposed to be the, you know, break the bank. It was supposed to be the thing, and its numbers aren't that much different than Justice League's numbers last August.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And, you know, and I think, you know, Avengers versus X-Men is something that's going to excite the base. I mean, what fan wouldn't want to see this series? It's been well marketed. Marvel has their top talent on it. By all accounts, it's a tremendous book, and I'm sure it'll be very entertaining. People have fun with it, but it's niche. There's no other way to describe it as far as a mass audience is concerned. And I try to figure out mass audiences all day in my line of work. You know, I try to push games out there that millions of people are going to want to play. In terms of mass audiences, you know, a series that's about these two superhero books that have been running for 50 years that are as internally folded in upon each other as Avengers and especially X-Men are concerned. I mean, the exciting incident of this book is you have to understand an event that occurred in, you know, what, in 1978? When was the death of Jean Grey? Like X-Men number 137, right?
It's going,
the issue?
Yeah. Some of the stuff in it is going, I mean, you're going back to the 70s for Phoenix. You're going back. I mean, House of M, I know nothing about. And I'm a hardcore reader, and I really only have the vaguest knowledge of House of M.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're looking at like a 5-year plan, which, you know, from the outside, they're bragging about having had a 5-year plan. From my perspective of trying to get back into the X-Men, I'm like, am I actually supposed to go back and read 5 years worth of stuff to figure out what's going on this month?
I mean, on one level, it's very cool. And if we lived in a world where there were, you know, 5 million people or 8 million people or 10 million people. Let's say say the audience in North America that potentially could reach the comic book or superhero book would be 10 million people. Those are the hardcore guys that turn up for the first weekend of Avengers. If 10 million of them were interested in comics and they were interested in that comic, then, wow, that'd be a really cool world to live in. But that's just not the world we live in. And you're never going to reach that kind of audience with those kind of editorial choices. But I'm sure that the comic guys, you know, the publishers are going to say, we've done all these initiatives to reach a broader market. We do comics that are based on cartoons. We do comics that are trying to appeal to kids. We do, you know, we have the whole Ultimate line at Marvel, which pulled out all that continuity. And they're going to point at how everything gradually, month by month, still runs down because that's the nature of the business. And then they become really efficient at operating inside that niche about publishing books that are going to sell between 40 and 100,000 copies, that they can write a laser-focused solicitation for Diamond and know plus or minus 2% how many copies they're going to sell, and that allows them to operate a business. Become very efficient at selling these kinds of books. There's nobody over there that knows how to make anything else. And that would not be exposed as a sin, except that you have superhero movies that are selling like crazy, and you have access now to this digital market that should allow these properties to blow up and go wide, but they don't know how to do it.
Yeah, and we haven't seen that kind of crossover from the film and TV world into comics really since Batman.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't really happen with Spider-Man. You know, there might have been some, again, lapsed readers that came back because they got excited about comics again. But, I mean, it's really been since Batman came out in the 80s that we had people going to see a movie and then going, you know, I do want to read comics now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know what gets us there because licensed material doesn't seem to do it.
Yeah, again, it's a, you know, it's kind of a niche, right? We know there are cultures in the world that embrace comics in a more mainstream fashion. If you're in Japan, you know, you're going to read these huge black and white manga volumes while you're on the train going into work, and they cover all sorts of territories, not just specifically superheroes. You know, the superhero market, the comic book market, as it's evolved in North America, is this kind of peculiar thing. But superheroes are still tremendously popular. You know, going back again to the success of these feature pictures, and it's certainly not just Avengers. It's also Iron Man and Captain America and Thor. And anytime Warner's makes a movie about a superhero named Batman, they do really well. The other characters, they're still figuring it out. But those are four quadrant pictures. There's a date night pictures. People show up on Friday in droves. They go to midnight showings. There's enormous interest in science fiction, fantasy, all the things that are fan-ish. But there's not a lot of interest in comic books. So we have to look at those two things. You know, what are the movies doing right that the comics are not? Part of it is the medium. Part of it is, you know, somebody that's interested in seeing Avengers, you know, seeing one superhero movie a year is not the same guy that maybe is going to turn out and buy 12 comics a year. But there's also, you know, the storytelling and the emphasis that they're putting in the comics just doesn't appeal to a mass audience. And I hate to keep harping on it because I just sound like, you know, well, I'm so wise, why don't I fix it, right? But as a, you know, as a consumer, I'm genuinely disappointed because I got two little kids. I got a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old. I've got 8,000 comic books in my garage. I love comics. I write a weekly comic blog. I've worked in the business. I take them to comic shops, and I can't find a thing for them. I can't get them interested in anything comic books. They'll go out and they'll watch the movies. They're happy to do that. But be a comics fan, not on your life. And if they've lost younger generations, and they lost my kids, they lost everyone. Of course, there are kids that enjoy comics, continue to read them. But if they aren't coming in vast numbers to replace the users or the players, now I'm talking game terms, the readers that are becoming disaffected with the editorial stunts and aging off the top of the stack, then over time they can't help but to dwindle away until there's no readership left at all.
Well, and that's something that one of my co-hosts who has a young boy, he wants to get him into comics, and he looks around the store and there's one or two things, but what he's actually doing is he's getting that one or two things and he's getting issues of G.I. Joe from the 80s that he read when he was a kid. And he's getting these books that, you know, it's the all ages book. It's not books for kids. Like I always say that it's not the books for kids that I was actually missing. Yes, there are great books for 6-year-olds. And there are great books for 19-year-olds. But I don't think there are a lot of great books for 12 to 15-year-olds at the age I started reading it.
Yeah.
And well, most of us start.
There's a saying that the golden age of anything is 12, right? So the first post I put on my Longbox Graveyard blog was the golden age of comics is 12. And when I was 12, it's 1974. That's what I think about comics. That's why I'm printed. But the thing about the comics market in the 70s and even into the 80s is that comics were just comics. You know, what drove Marvel to become a pop sensation starting in the 1960s with the Stan Lee, Jack Kirby books and then through the 60s into the 70s is that they just wrote comic books. They didn't think of them in terms of this is for kids, this is for adults, this is for mature audiences, this is ages X and up. They just wrote comics that kids can understand, that adults could also find something to enjoy. It was a magic time. And what you have now is you have books that you wouldn't want your kids to see that are catering towards an increasingly more adult audience that have material in them that wouldn't fly on network television, for instance, because it's too violent or it's too sexy or it's too bloody or whatever your rejection is going to be. So you can't recruit new readers unless the material is approachable. But because readers have vacated the space, and because the readers that exist respond to this, you know, specific kind of storytelling, then of course that's what the publishers are going to provide. We've wound up with the market we deserve as readers, but that's not the market that's going to allow the comics to thrive and really compete with a mass audience through digital downloads. So, I mean, I'm glad you guys had me on the show. It's fascinating to talk about it. I came on all prepared to talk about how comics need to adopt virtual pricing and all these things they could do on the technical and on the distribution side. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know what, even if they fix all those things, the editorial problem is so severe that I think they'll just destroy what little profitable business they still have. And maybe they really do need to circle the wagons, continue to sell digital books at $3.99 as long as they can get away with it. And then, you know, when the time comes and the publishers are shut down, at least they'll say, well, we got another 5-8 years out of it before we lost everything.
So the Marvel AR app is not going to save us? Is that what you're saying?
Well,
it may be just a gimmick cover.
Do you want to read a comic book by looking through the lens of an iPhone to see if things move around or animate for you? Is that what you want?
We gave that a pretty negative review, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's not what I want.
Well, I do wonder if things have to bottom out as much as they did in the 50s. I mean, it's something that's forgotten a lot when you talk about where comics are at and, you know, where people are, you know, the sky is falling, that the greatest comics that we know, that most people agree that the best stuff was created in the early 60s when DC came back and was doing science fiction superhero books, and then the Marvel characters were created. All of that came out of comic books almost disappearing. Certainly superhero comics had disappeared to the extent, you know, down to, you know, a half dozen or so characters that survived through the 50s. It had to bottom out that badly before DC said, you know, what if we create a new version of the Flash, a new version of Green Lantern, who are sci-fi characters and appeal to a different audience? That it actually had to get to that. It was based, like, you know, this famous story of Stan Lee creating the Fantastic Four was, and creating Spider-Man, I should say, was that they had one more issue that they were going to publish of a comic, and the publisher said, well, do whatever the hell you feel like.
Yeah.
And so he's like, well, I'm just going to create this weird character, and he and Ditko came up with this thing. And it was that desperation of, we're about to wrap things up, so let's just really do something, and let's come up with this neat idea, because we've got, you know, we've got the paper already. So let's run something off.
And, you know, desperation focuses the mind wonderfully, right? And there's plenty of stories in my business on the app side of small developers saying, oh, we published 50 games, we're ready to pitch it in, and then we tried this thing like Angry Birds, and it's successful, right? And now they got 600 million downloads. I mean, there's lots of companies that are 10-year overnight success stories, and maybe the next wave of comics will have a similar story to tell. The thing that's different now from 1956 or 1961, when these Thunderbolts came in the form of the Flash and in the form of Fantastic Four, is they had a print distribution channel that they could push a book through, and it would get on stands and kids could find it. So, yeah, they have this book called Amazing Fantasy that's already running these Twilight Zone kinds of stories that Ditko and Lee were doing. And let's take issue number 15 and try out this Spider-Man character to see what happens. And they already had a floor. They could already guarantee that they'd be able to push out, I don't know how many copies of Amazing Fantasy number 15 shipped. Let's say it was 80,000 copies, 100,000, maybe it was more than that. But they knew they had a thriving newsstand market that they knew they could ship things into on a returnable basis. If the book didn't sell, they just strip the cover and send it back and get their credit, you know. So they were able to reach an audience, but when they got the product right, they were able to reach the audience, and then they had this huge success. But right now, they can't get the product right, and they can't reach an audience. So even if they got the product right, how are they going to get it out to the audience? That should be the promise of digital, but building up that digital audience is going to be expensive. You know, and they're going to have to take some heavy losses, and they're going to have to say goodbye to their print channel, because they can't continue to price protect on the digital side if they want to grow. But, geez, you know, I can understand why they don't want to do it, because I don't think they know how to do it.
Well, now that we've successfully not answered our key questions.
Sorry.
But we've had some... I think it brings a whole different angle, though, to these discussions. And I think this has become an ongoing discussion, because there is no solid answer. And, you know, we're kind of looking at things as people experiment with things like Marvel AR, with the Infinite comics, which we didn't talk about. I don't know if you had read that, the AVX Infinite.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good initiative. I think that embracing what technology can bring in terms of the way they tell stories digitally is smart. And it doesn't have to be a motion comic, doesn't have to have sound and animation, but just recognizing that, you know, people are experiencing these things on tablets now, or on, you know, the panel display should conform to an iPhone. I think that's really smart. There's an excellent app called Operation Ajax, which was published by... I want to say Condito is the name of the company. Operation Ajax is an iPad-only app It's like premium app, $4.99 or something like that. And it's brilliant. It's a graphic novel about the most unapproachable subject you can imagine, which is the secret story of the CIA in Iran in the 1950s. I have no idea why they picked that, aside from it being a passion project. But it's a 120-page graphic novel that was built for the iPad tablet and the tablet only, that is brilliant in the way it reinvents the way comics can be told, but it's clearly still a comic book. It does have an ambient soundtrack, but it doesn't read to you. It does have some small motion, but it's not a motion comic. It must have been, in fact, I know it was frighteningly expensive to create, but it's a real vision for what can be done with the space if you can embrace the technology. But you can only embrace the technology and absorb that kind of cost to produce the material, again, if you're reaching an audience in millions. And certainly they aren't with Operation Ajax. That same technology applied to a superhero title might be able to reach that wider market. But again, if the material is unapproachable, if it's too bloody, too dark, too violent, too internalized, too dependent upon decades of continuity, it's just not going to fly. The attention span of your average app guy is they'll go out and they'll gillnet 20 or 30 free apps on a Thursday, and they'll give them 5 to 8 seconds each before they decide if they're ever going to open them again. And inside that environment, existing editorial approach to selling to creating these comics, it just won't fly. Just won't.
All right, well, we're going to wrap this up for tonight. And thank you so much for coming on the show, Paul, and giving us this very different perspective. And I'm sure we'll be referencing back to this for sure. As we muddle through the changes that are happening in comics. And yeah. We are going to have you back in a couple weeks. We want to talk about your professional time in comics, because you talk about that 12-year-old golden age. Well, my silver age, I guess, was when I was 20.
Well, if you want to talk about my comics profession, it'll be a much shorter show. I guarantee that one. And in closing about this, on this digital comics thing, I hate to be the voice of doom, and let me say for the record, nothing would please me more than to be wrong. I mean, nothing would please me more to be wrong. I love comics. I want them to survive. I want them to thrive. I want them to evolve for a new era. I want comics to be for everyone. I mean, I think that would be a wonderful future. And I hope that I am wrong. I hope Marvel and DC can figure this out. I hope they can reach a mass market. I hope they can get their editorial turned around. I'd be delighted to be wrong on this one, but I'm afraid I'm not.
I'm always thrilled when I'm wrong. it pleases me a great deal because it's a rare occurrence.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks. Thanks
again, Paul. And Paul, you want to plug your blog?
Oh, sure. It's called Long Box Graveyard. So you go to www.longboxgraveyard.com. Talk about all sorts of comics, primarily Marvels from the 70s, but I've cast it a little wider since then. We do a little digital comics coverage too. There's a new blog every Wednesday. So longboxgraveyard.com. Check it out, please. Thank you.